acting, especially by women in Iran, was frowned upon. So that's why every time a gentleman asked for my hand, I would have asked him right there and then, how would you like me to start acting? This one said yes, and I married him.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Another episode of Story and Craft. Thank you so much for stopping back by. I sincerely appreciate it. Now, if this is your first episode, my name is Mark Preston, and I'm glad to have you along. Especially for today's episode, I have been trying to get this guest on. For some time now, I've wanted to sit down with Shorey Agadashlu for some time, and really am jazzed to bring you this episode, because she's got a great story to tell. In fact, we spent a lot of time chatting about her background, being from Iran, and what it was like for her to start there and the path she took to come be an Academy Award nominated actor, an Emmy Award winning actor who has been in all kinds of great projects. You know her from playing Avasarala in the sci-fi show, one of my favorite sci-fi shows, actually, The Expanse, also been in 24, The Flight Attendant, on-screen movies such as Star Trek Beyond. She was in The X-Men, and of course, The House of Sand and Fog. That's the movie she got the Academy Award nomination for. She also does a lot of voiceover work as well. In fact, right now you can hear her as the voice of the dragon in the Netflix movie Damsel. Shorey is such a pleasure, and I'm so glad to bring you this episode. Now, don't forget, if you would, go ahead and subscribe to the show. That way, if you're like me, the shows I like to listen to, I like to see a little notification pop up when my favorite shows have a new episode. And if you subscribe, of course, that'll get you a little notification every time there's a new episode. Also, if you would, make sure to leave a review, leave some stars, like the show, just show a little love. It goes a long way and is much appreciated. Also, everything you could possibly want to know about the show, just head to storyandcraftpod.com and you're all set. All right, let's get after it. Today is Shorey Agadashlu Day, right here on Story and Craft. Before we start, I want to say it's Shorey, correct? Am I
that's
saying
right,
it incorrect?
That's right. It's Shorey, yeah. You don't have to, yes, kind of drag the E, Shorey. It's just Shorey. But I have to tell you a story about this one. I think I have put too many H's in my name. S-H-O-H-R-E-H. And when I was working with Stephen Kingsley, since he's such a gentleman, every morning he made sure that he would say hello to me first. He would come to me and say, good morning, Shorey. I'm like, Jesus, how am I going? One day I told him, Stephen, I think I put too many H's in my name. You don't have to pronounce each and every one of them. So yeah, it's Shorey.
You know, I've heard him in interviews before. He seems to be kind of a very, has a very kind of a dry, sneaky sense of humor. I don't know. I mean, that's the sense
yes,
I get from him.
Right.
But he does seem to have a good sense of humor.
Amazing sense of humor. It's unbelievable. And the thing is that he could go on, making jokes and you know, having fun and laughing while walking towards the set. But the moment he puts his foot on the set, the whole world turns into the world of the character that he's living in. It's just incredible how he does that. First day, when he started joking, tell me, you know, jokes, and we were both laughing, and I was thinking, how am I going to work with him? He's so happy, and this is a tragedy. And when we got to the set, he just entered. All of a sudden, his chest started going up, his head going up, and said, good morning, everyone. And he was Colonel Behrani. He was Colonel Behrani. It was just incredible. Yeah. He's an amazing actor.
Yeah, there was a physicality to, at the beginning of House of
Sand. Yeah.
Sand and Fog. Am I saying it's House of Sand and Fog? When he was giving a speech, he has a very proud demeanor about him, you know, most certainly.
Very much so. And what I love about him and actors like him, or Daniel Day-Lewis, Sir Hopkins, it's not just the soul of the character that they work on. They work on the character's physicality as well. But to me, the most smart questions for the first meetings are, tell me how my character looks like. Is she short? Is she tall? Is she overweight? Is she thin? And Ben Kingsley, Daniel Day-Lewis, they first think, I have a feeling that they first think about the physicality of their character. Like when Ben Kingsley is portraying a general, Iranian general, proud Iranian general, obviously he turns into a proud general with his head held high. So Daniel Day-Lewis, I love the way he walks in the film that's called what? There Will Be Blood. I think actors should study his walking only. I mean, his physicality, where he got his character from.
You know, that's one of the only films I have not seen. I'm trying to think. There Will Be Blood. That is that Paul Thomas Anderson? The director directed that.
Yes, of course. Yes,
that's the only of one of his films I haven't seen yet. But There Will Be Blood. I that is still on my list of things
brilliant.
To see.
Brilliant question. Question. If you really have a question about mixing governments with religions, if you ever have a question about bringing religion into our conversations and interactions, what happens? What happens when we do that? It's just incredible. And I think Daniel Day-Lewis has done an amazing job. He's turned into this man. And it affected me so well. I called my daughter and I said, you have to see this film because this is a conversation between religion and government and power.
Well, you, of course, probably... You more than most people in your own life experience, I don't mean to get kind of too far ahead, but being from Iran, then probably have a more acute sense of kind of the blending of faith and politics. It seems like there was a, in your history, and kind of in 1979 was just such a pivotal swing when people think Iran now. I feel like it's such a majestic, interesting, dynamic, just a cool culture. But unfortunately, seems to be getting kind of quashed by talk of the politics. And I just kind of wanted your feedback on that, because I haven't spoken with anybody who kind of saw things pre and post, 1979. Just kind of generally your thoughts and kind of how that affected you and influenced you. And I know that's such a broad question, but
no, you're right. You're right. I know exactly where you're coming from. You are absolutely right. The reason I am more interested in political, either religious, political, or just pure political films is because of the fact that I have seen it firsthand, how a secular society overnight turns into a religious tyranny. I have seen how it works, and I have seen how it ends usually. Because of the people, the more kind of religious people you have in your country, the more susceptible you are to a religious tyranny, unfortunately. So I've seen it firsthand.
Growing up in Iran, what was the experience like? And have you been back since then in recent years? Have you been able to kind of do the A-B comparison and kind of the aesthetic, what it felt like to be there?
I'm afraid not. I have not been able to travel back to my birth country for almost 45 years now. I left right at the time of the turmoil. As soon as I heard that there were rumors, but usually one should take rumors seriously if one wants to stay away from, troubles. And as soon as I heard that Ayatollahs are coming, what is this? Ayatollah Khomeini is coming from France via Air France. He has refused to come in with an Iranian plane. He wants to come in with a French plane. And I'm thinking, oh my God, why do I feel a conspiracy here? And why shouldn't he not come in an Iranian plane? He's coming in with the help of his allies. And this looks bad. And I don't want to stay here. I don't want to live here for now. So on February 28th.
But you were very young too, and to be able to make such big decisions at that age, that's a big decision to make.
Yes, I was 26, to be honest with you. To be honest with you, sometimes it surprises myself as well that how smart I was at the age of 26 when I decided to leave the mayhem behind and just go to Europe and try my chance over there, because I knew I was an actress and I knew that under religious tyranny, under mullahs, there wouldn't be a place for an outspoken young actress. I was back then. But unfortunately, I made up my mind too late. The prime minister at the time had already ordered all the airports to shut down. And for him to have some time to think about us, what to do with the Ayatollah when he arrives. And as soon as I heard it from the radio that airports have been shut down, I thought that I told my dog, my beloved dog, Pasha, his name was Pasha, in Turkish means sir. I told Pasha, I said, Pasha, destination is unknown. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I cannot take you with me. But I am leaving February 28, 1978, 4 a.m. I jumped into my car and drove to the UK. I was familiar with the life in London.
Well, of course, it begs the question of a little bit more origin story. What, you know, as far as your family goes, did you come from a big family? Were you an only child? Or second part of the question is, what kind of career did your folks have?
Well, my father was a deputy at the Ministry of Health. My mother used to be a teacher. But when she gave birth to my brother, my father asked her to stay home and try to teach us. Rather than teaching the strange kids. And my mother accepted it. After that, she gave birth to two more sons. We are a big family, including cousins, and you know how tribal it is in that part of the world. And very loving parents. My mother was 20, my father was 22. So you can imagine how young they were and how much love they could have given me. And I started acting at the age of 20. I got married at the age of 19 because my parents did not agree with me to become an actor. But my suitor did. And as soon as he told me that there is no problem for me to start acting, I accepted proposal.
Having a partner who gives you unconditional support, that's an important thing. Yeah,
that's it. You said you could have not said it more beautifully. That's it. He was a partner that he would never, never leave me alone. He would always back me up in every which way. And we got married a couple of months later. A friend of his who was working at the City Theatre told me that the City Theatre was looking for an actress to play a very important role in a play by one of my favorite writers, playwrights, Edward Bond. It was called The Narrow Road to the Deep North. I went for an audition. I was accepted and I started acting. By the age of 26, when the turmoil started, I was already a successful actress on my way. I had already won a couple of awards.
Somebody once said, it's like, if you can imagine yourself doing anything else, this isn't the thing for you. Did you kind of at a very young age go, this is what I'm going to do? Or was it just one of a few things?
One of the few things, I should say, because when I was 5 years old, I already knew that I would love to act, but didn't say anything because I didn't know what acting was. When I was 16 years of age, we were, our family, we were all staying with my uncle in the Caspian Sea. He was a merchant. He was into cotton fields. And his lifestyle was very much like Pride and Prejudice, one of my favorite books. He had six daughters, three sons, and when the four of us joined them, we had the time of our lives. It was the most beautiful, beautiful trips I've ever taken in my life. And every time we were there, my uncle and his wife would take us to see a movie once a week on Fridays, equivalent of Sundays here in the Western world. And we went to see Gone with the Wind, and I was mesmerized.
So were Western films very popular? You know, films from the U.S. or the U.K., were they very popular in Iran?
Very much so. We dubbed the movies. We were so lazy. We dubbed the movies, but they were dominating the whole, you know, the whole arena of theater cinemas in Iran. The Western films were dominating. To be honest with you, when I was a teenager, I watched mostly Western films than Iranian films. But when I left Iran, I started watching more Iranian films. It's interesting. Yeah. And another reason was because my mother was an avid reader, God rest her soul. All my life, childhood life, all I remember is my mother reading a book and talking about Daphne, Emily, Charlotte. And my brothers and I are like, who are these people? These are Bronte's sisters, sorry. Bronte's sisters. They are the best writers, one of the best writers on the face of the earth. Jane Austen, sorry. Gurur wa Ta'assub, Pride and Prejudice. Read it, sorry. She was all the time talking about the Western literature and how rich it is. And if you want to.
So story was a big thing for you as you're growing up. The idea of story and storytelling and kind of getting lost in story.
Very much so.
Now, when you came over, did any of your family come with you either then or after? Or, you know, how did that work out?
No, I'm afraid I was alone. I was alone, but my aunt lived in London. She was my only hope. And she was in London at that time. Usually, she would just travel to London in the summers and stay in Iran in the winters. But she happened to be in London, and I was hoping that I would join her. Soon as I arrived, I sold my car. I had a Mercedes-Benz convertible, green, and it was called Sanjak.
Oh, wait, was it with the little two-door? Little two-door Mercedes?
That's right, yes.
Oh, my grandmother, rest her soul, she, you know, my whole life, she had a Lincoln Town car, but she always wanted that car, circa, not the newer ones, but the ones that were by early 80s, late 70s, you know, that was her ideal car, you know, and she wanted it in gold, if I remember right. when you came over, I mean, that's, I mean, digesting what a brave move that was. I mean, was there just no other option in your mind? Like this is the only option. So did that just make it easier for you? Like this is the only thing to do, or you know, to be that young, it's still kind of mind-boggling that you made that choice.
It was the only option. It was the only option for me to get out and to get myself educated, highly educated. I had a diploma. I didn't have a major. So I had to study. And I studied from the beginning. I knew that I was going to sell my car. I was going to sell my jewelries, no matter how much they're going to be sold for. And I'm going to start studying politics because I wanted to know what was happening in Iran. Why the turmoil at such time, 3 months after the Shah of Iran announced Iranian oil independence. He said it. He said it out loud to the whole world that we're not selling our oil for half its price or one quarter of its real price. We're selling it for its right price, like others do. And 3 months later, he was toppled. So I just wanted to know what's happening.
Did you have any sense, having grown up there, that there was going to be this change? Did you feel like, for lack of a better way of putting it, a tide coming? Or was it just all of a sudden it just happened, you know? Did you feel any kind of evolution happening?
If I want to compare it to anything in real life or movies, I would definitely say what happened in Iran is very much similar to what happens in one of my favorite TV series of all times, Handmaid's Tale. Overnight, the clock is turned back 1300 years. I swear, I'm always wishing to meet Margaret Atwood and ask this amazing writer where she got her tip from, because she started writing the novels in 1979. The revolution in Iran took in 1978. What happened? I'm dying to talk to her and find out where she got the idea from, and why is this so similar to what happened in Iran? It means that, in my knowledge, it means that when superpowers make a decision, there is nothing you can do. As an individual, you just have to go with it. Either you save yourself, leave, or you stay and you go through a lot.
Now, what was your going back when you decided you were wanting to act? Was that well received by your family? Were they very encouraging? Were they a little bit, I don't know about that. How did they receive that idea?
The problem is that I wish they had received it well. My mother was fine, but my father was not happy with the idea. I remember when I told my mother, when we were watching Gone with the Wind in the interwar, all the other kids were asking for sodas, popcorns, this and that. And my mother said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want to become an actress." And she said, "Not under our roof. You know, acting is frowned upon in Iran. Acting, especially by women in Iran, was frowned upon. We couldn't." And she said, "No, sorry, you cannot do this." So that's why every time a gentleman asked for my hand, I would have asked him right there and then, "How would you like me to start acting?" And this one said yes, and I married him.
When did you get to the U.S. and start working over here?
Allow me to tell you something about the actors. According to Antonin Artaud, in Iran we called him the father of theater. According to him, an actor is someone who is standing in the middle of fire, pointing out the truth. Obviously, the actor is going to be burned, obviously, but actors do not mind going through the process. Actors do not mind to be burned. I never forget what Frank Sinatra said about Judy Garland. It's beautiful. Frank Sinatra says, "Judy Garland dies a little every time she sings." And he's absolutely right. We die a little every time we act, but we don't mind because we're like butterflies around the candle. We don't mind to be burned for the right cause. How I started acting here. This is really interesting. When they say chance, they really mean it. I was traveling when DreamWorks, the production company of the movie House of Sand and Fog, was looking for an actress to play the role of the general's wife. I was traveling. I was on a theatrical tour. I had recently back, and I was sitting in my office, and the phone rang, and the lady on the phone was asking for Surya Abidasluya. And I said, "That sounds like my name, but it's not my name." She goes, "Whatever your name is, would you like to come down and sort it out?" And I said, "Where to?" She said, "DreamWorks." And I started shaking a little bit. And I said, "Regarding?" She said, "The House of Sand and Fog." And I went speechless because I had already read the book.
Oh, okay, okay.
And I told, yeah, I'd already read the book. And while reading it, apparently on one occasion I was making miserable sounds like, and my husband asked me, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "If one day they make a movie out of this book and do not give me this role, then there is no democracy in this country. That would be very unfair."
Well, how cool is that? That's to read a book or to see a screenplay, anything, and go, "That's the thing I want to do," and get a call. So you're probably trying not to act too excited, you know, but how fast did you get down to the casting office or the DreamWorks?
The day after. But my mistake was because I thought that my character is always coiffed up in that story. And that's how Iranian women are. When they wake up, rather than having breakfast, first they would just take care of their hair and face and put a nice dress on, and then they come for breakfast. That's how she was. And that's why I went out of my way. As soon as I received the call, I went to Nordstrom, bought myself some expensive pieces, put a lot of makeup on, went to the audition, and the director, Vadim Perelman, he looked at me and he said, "Oh, no, 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 no. go home, come back tomorrow without makeup. And I said, but this woman is always coiffed up to her teeth. He goes, I understand, but I want to do this. I want to portray this woman without makeup. So I came home. I found a pair of black jeans, very old ones, black t-shirt, which was almost yellow, and put my hair in a bun. Because I didn't want to use my hair as a dramatic tool, and went for the audition, and I got it.
But you fundamentally understood who this character was, and her. You already had a.
Yes.
You kind of already did the homework, as they say. You already knew who she was.
Inside out, I knew. When I was reading the book, I always thought that, my God, I know a woman like this in Iran. Oh my God, I came across another woman like this in Iran. So I was pretty familiar with. So the day after, I put a jeans, pair of black, torn, kind of old jeans, a black shirt that was almost yellow, and it was so old. Put my hair, I had a long hair, put my hair in a bun because I didn't want to use my hair as a dramatic tool. When I was leaving, the director told me, come back tomorrow and see if you can make me cry. And I was determined to make him cry. No makeup, nothing. I went to the audition. Four scenes I was supposed to audition for. He asked me if I would like to take a pause in between the scenes. And I said, no, thank you. And he said, why not? And I said, I want to get to the crescendo and make you cry. And he said, let's try. And he cried and gave me the role.
That has to be quite an empowering feeling, you know. You mentioned how she wore makeup. Was there always a sense of, like my grandmother, rest her soul, she would never leave. She wouldn't go to the grocery store. We're from Dallas, you know. It's the thing. You wouldn't leave the house without putting your face on, you know. Was that kind of the same thing, to be dressed, to have the makeup on? Was that kind of the way that ladies more or less operated in Iran?
It's not just leaving the house, even in the house. They're supposed to get ready. My aunt, for example, my mother wasn't that much. She was a nerd. She was always reading or up to some new kind of convention or whatever. But my aunt would wake up at 5 a.m., 1 hour before her husband, who was a general, that was going to wake up, because she was beautiful. She was beautiful. My family side on my mother's side are blonde, white and blonde, because they're coming from the north of Iran. And she was like a doll, but still, she had to wake up at 5 a.m., comb her hair, style it, put a nice lipstick on, a little bit of rouge on her cheeks, not wear a nice dress. And then they had, of course, they had domestic help. She would just start putting everything on the table. She would make, and my aunt would make herself like a doll and would sit on the breakfast table waiting for her husband. So when the husband sees her, he would see this beautiful lady in a nice dress sitting at a table having breakfast with him.
You know, to kind of go back what we were talking about before, you know, in 1978, 79, now the position women have or don't have in Iran. You know, it must bring, must warm your heart to see the young people protesting, to kind of see, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed, moving the needle, you know. And how do you feel things are moving? Do you feel there's movement in a good direction, or do you feel it's stagnated when you watch the news or you talk to family? What's your perception of Iran in 2024?
I wouldn't say that it has died down. I would say it has gone underground. Yes, it's in general, Iran is a lot quieter than it used to be last year, same time, when 1,500 young people were killed on the surface of the streets just because of having a peaceful demonstrations. It looks calmer, but the real problem beneath all of these is the fact that not until the whole world agrees with the Iranian people who are asking for freedom, who are asking for a secular society, would not happen until the whole world agrees with them, until the world stop buying Iranian oil for one third of its real price. Who wants to buy the oil for its real price when they can buy it for half a price? It's all about money. It's about geographic, strategic geographic position of Iran in the region, and not until the world realizes that they need to leave Iran alone, not just Iran, but all the countries that have been occupied, leave them alone and let them go through the same process as the others did and got where we are right now, turned into an advanced technological country. Let it breathe, let it live.
You know, your studies in government, you study government, is what you said, correct? And
international relations, political science. Yeah, I had to.
So that was kind of your journey to kind of deconstruct and kind of figure out, have it make sense to you what was going on, you know, or have it, maybe it didn't mean they're doing.
Back to your question about the expanse. It's really interesting. You were saying that deconstructing. Had I not studied politics, I would have never been able to pull it off as well as they say I did. Because what I did, the first episode, when it arrived, I started reading it and I started decoding it. That's how I can portray my characters, decode what people say, decode what the cities or the names that have been put there, fictional, of course. Try to find out what the writers or the novelists are trying to tell you. Is this, where is this coming from? This Martians, who could they stand for? Martians, Belters, Earthers. So when I started decoding them, I realized what was going on. And then I started working on my character.
One of the things I think was captured very well, I'm not a Trekkie, I'm not a Star Trek guy, but I appreciate Star Trek because it really addressed real core human issues through the spectrum of the sci-fi stuff, you know. And that's something that I think you could see the expanse many moons from now actually being a real thing, you know, colonizing Mars, people on Mars going, wait a minute, why don't we have our autonomy? Why are we beholden? And then for you it should have, like, as you said, made a lot of sense, you know, everybody's struggle, their desires. Would you say that the beginning of Avasarala, she was very political, you know, she was more of a political animal early on and then evolved from there? Would you say that's accurate?
Absolutely. It's her journey. I believe it's the journey of every politician. Let's take Margaret Thatcher for that reason. And let's see how she started, what she was trying to do, how she represented the crown, and where she ended up being, and how once she was not liked by many, but now she is a hero. It all depends on the politician's journey. And the way the novelist did it, they did an amazing job because she takes a real arc, as in real life. She is a politician, but at the same time, she's a mother. She's a wife.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, the fact that the mother aspect seemed to color, really, that was everything was floating on that experience, or the experience of your son. By the way, if anybody hasn't seen The Expanse, and if you're listening to this, spoilers everywhere. your son dying really, I think that not only influenced you, but also helped you connect to the other characters. And it was so well written, you know, because there was an easy empathy that your character seemed to have with even Frankie Adams' character. You know, here is somebody who's a military grunt, but you made a connection. And you know, ultimately, the relationship you had with Wes Chatham's character was arguably my favorite. You know, just I'm kind of wondering, you know, just, you know, calling you Chrissy, You know, like where, how it evolved is such a
well written.
Did you have any input? It seems like whoever was involved in wardrobe, it seems like that kind of evolved, and there was more. It almost seemed like they were they hooking into your own lineage, your own history, and trying to. It seems like you were the jewelry, the wardrobe. It was bigger. It was yes. Not loud. That vibrant
and larger. Yeah.
Did you have any discussion with them about that? About the way you were wanting to look and the way you were wanting to present?
Day one, when I went for a fitting with Jian Hansen, our designer, the series designer, costume designer. As soon as I opened the door. The dress was on a mannequin, the costume. I looked at it and I just bowed to her and I said, what an amazing job you have done. What an amazing job. East meets West here. And this is what I love about this costume. She looks at me and very humble. She says, is there anything you'd like to add to it? I'm like, oh boy, what a humble designer. And I said, well, honestly, yeah, every single time she was like, what would you like? If there's anything you would like to change or add, please let me know. We'll do it by all means. And I looked at the outfit and I thought, the costume, and I thought, well, with this costume, I am going to enter a pretty dangerous area. And what I remember from Alfred Hitchcock's movies was that every time a scene was going to be dangerous or danger was about to come, he would use the color red. He would use red. And I said, I talked to Joanne about Alfred Hitchcock's use of colors in his movies. And I said, do you think we can just make her cufflinks red, or give her a red necklace, because she's about to enter the dangerous zone. And I like to give the audience, if the audience are familiar with Hitchcock's movies, they would say, why is she wearing red? Is this going to be dangerous? Is this scene going to be dangerous or what? She was always, all the time. And to be honest with you, I haven't seen anything like her yet. I've worked almost 50 years now, half a century. She is really one of a kind.
Yeah, I have to say, of the whole show, and there are wonderful characters, such yes. an incredible ensemble. And it seems like there was a lot of love and care put into your character by, like you mentioned, just the wardrobe and things like that. It's such an aesthetically interesting show to watch. It's so funny because it was a couple of years ago, I just happened upon it. Expanse, I was like, I'm going to watch it one day. And it grabbed me immediately. And I have to say, Officer Allah is the one. You know, you're one of the main reasons I was pulled into that ecosystem.
Thank you so much. But I have to tell you something. It's really interesting. This show has received a lot of great reviews. I haven't even received one bad one. But my favorite of them all is a real scientist review on this show. In 2.5 pages, he proves to you as to why Expanse is the most accurate version of the future. If we are not being careful, keep polluting our air and our oceans. This is the end. And you're right, because every time I read the script, I felt like, my God, it sounds supposedly 200 years, 300 years from now, but it relatively speaks for today. It is already happening.
Indeed. It's a such a wonderful analogy and metaphors and all. And I spoke with Neil deGrasse Tyson about a little over a year ago. We're talking about our favorite sci-fi shows, which one we thought got it right. And of course, Neil deGrasse Tyson doesn't hold, you know, bite his tongue when we're talking about the movie The Martian with Matt Damon. But I mentioned The Expanse and I was wanting to get his feedback. He said it's on his list of things to see. He hadn't seen it. I was like, you got to watch it. We've got to talk again. I want to get your feedback. What you think about the, you know, yes, some things, there's creative license taken, but the human aspect of it, like you mentioned your son, even to go to the show 24, But it was about your son having the son thing, I guess, is a through line. But I am curious about the 24 thing. I've spoken with, I think, two folks who were on 24. That show, I don't think people realize, who a little bit younger, how big 24 was for its time.
Unbelievable. It was unbelievable. We even had some problems with Iran. Some politicians in Iran spoke against 24, saying that, where do they get these names from? I do remember there was a name involved. One of the terrorists' name was Mansouri. And apparently there was one in Iran. And they were like, where do they get their names from? Why are they trying to make us look bad? I remember they were very, very angry with it. But recently I heard that Qasem Soleimani, the general who was killed in Iraq, used to watch 24. Apparently he was a fan of 24. But most probably he realized while watching that this Mansouri is for real, and who's given the U.S. a tip that Mansouri is in charge of this. So, yeah, the 24 was huge. It has a cult in Japan. Yeah, still.
You know, it's one of those shows that you watched. It was you know, after 9/11. It came on right about the right time. People were thinking about terrorism being a thing. And, on, you know, I heard stories when they were filming. It was such a popular show. It was kind of hard to get, you know, film on location. So there's so many people wanting to come watch, you know. I am curious, how did the 24 come to you?
I received an offer for 24, and they only sent me the first two episodes. I called my agent and I said, I don't want to get myself involved with something that I have no idea how it is going to end, especially if I am going to portray a terrorist. I need to know what happens next. The answer was, they're not going to tell you, because they usually don't do that. And I passed on it. I said, send my love and regards to them and tell them I cannot get myself involved with this. Then they asked me to go in person, and so they can tell me the story. I went in. They told me the story and how it's going to end, and I accepted it.
Which it had to be difficult at that time to portray, I mean, in not a very savory way, people from that part of the world. Did you ever get any, I don't say backlash, did you get any people saying, why are you portraying it? Why are you maintaining stereotypes or anything? Did you ever get any of that?
Oh my God, a lot of those. But the worst one of them all was Radio Iran, KIRN 670 AM. Every single morning when I used to take my daughter to school, I used to listen to the news from Iran on this radio. And all of a sudden, it started talking about 24, that I'm playing a terrorist, and they received calls. The Iranians were saying that this is such a stereotype, she's making us look bad, blah, 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 to the point that I had to call them. One day I took my daughter to school, came back home, called them, asked them to put me on air. I said, by law, you need to put me on air. You keep talking behind my back. Put me on air. They did. And I said, first off, Iranians, please do realize that I'm an actress, I'm an actor. The more multi-layered the character is, the more I want to portray the character. Second of all, there is no such stereotype that I could be the stereo of it. The stereotype is when there is a type out there and you are the stereo of it. There is no such type out there. I created this woman from zilch, from zero. We don't even have one out there that I could take an example from. I created this woman. I created this character, the multi-layered character, the terrorist who is a woman, who is a wife, who is a mother, who is also believed so much in her mission and what she's supposed to do. So don't do this to me. And they stopped.
Yeah, I think that's difficult for some folks to see the abstract that, you know, I think some characters are so vibrant in their badness or whatever that people don't think that Yeah. They forget you're an actor. Maybe that's a good thing. They forget you're acting, you know?
That's a good thing.
It reminds me of one of the first books I read on acting like 25 years ago, Michael Caine's book, Acting in Film. It's a small book. And he said something that it's always good if one of the PAs on a set walks over to you and you're rehearsing with your another character and they say, oh, I don't mean to interrupt your conversation. He said, that's a good thing. If they come over and they say, hey, I don't mean to interrupt your rehearsal, that's not as good because they know you're acting, you know? But, you know, the experience of acting in 24, was it, was it a fast paced shooting schedule? Just because it's the show, is it like at a frenetic pace? I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it, was it a fun show to shoot?
It was a fun show to shoot because every single moment, something new would happen in 24 hours, more than a thousand things happen. So it was pretty fun. 12 hours a day. We started 6 a.m. sharp until 6 p.m. And producers, they were all on the same page. We have to go home, have dinner with our family. So should you. No matter what, we would stop at 7. Even if we went overtime, 10 to 7, everyone had to put whatever they had in their hands down and leave. Yeah, that's how dedicated.
Nestor Serrano is one of my Facebook friends, you know, so I always want to have him on show.
I love Nestor. I kept telling him, you're one of my favorite film husbands, show husbands. You're my favorite. You're one of the best. You're the best. And then when they decided to kill him and have me carry on with the mission, he came in and I said, oh, Nestor, you're leaving. He goes, you loved me so much, you had to kill me.
There was so much tension in that relationship because you knew the mission, but you know, the relationship, the husband and wife, but you're the mother first and foremost. It's one of those shows. I watched it by myself, the whole series twice, and then once with my kids. And during COVID, I mean, we went through the whole Lost series. It's probably unhealthy how many series we went through during COVID. But as far as your choices now, what you're looking to do, because you've had iconic, very recognizable things you've done. When you say from this point forward, what kind of things are you looking for? What turns you on and grabs you, be it a film or TV or your decision-making process?
From day one, when I started acting, when I wanted to become an actor, was for the fact that I wanted to tell a story. I'm really a storyteller. It's the story that grabs me. No matter how small or big my role or my character's portrayal is in this film or that TV series, what's important to me is the story. If it's meaningful, with all due respect to all entertaining films and TV series, I watch them a lot and they make me feel good. But when I want to work, when I want to be a part of a movie or a film or a TV series, I would rather do something meaningful that at least makes sense to my own self. Because sometimes when I'm watching a movie or series, I realize that actor is running his line but does not really know what he's talking about. I want to know what I'm talking about. That's why I'm looking for, which mostly it's independent films. Our hands are open to go for as deep as possible, go for meaningful films. But I'm looking for meaningful, somewhat entertaining, or even bizarre films. I remember that Christopher Walken was given an interview. And the interviewer asked him as to why he likes to play all these weirdos, weird characters. And he takes a long pause, looks into the interviewer's eyes, and he says, young man, I started acting when I was 6 years old. Who would you like me to play now? The guy next door. He's absolutely right. We've been there, we've done that, we've tried it. And now we're looking for something different.
Well, as far as different, was The Expanse, was that your first foray into sci-fi like that? I mean, outside of voiceover and outside like...
No, actually, the first one was X-Men The Last Stand.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Who was I speaking with the other day? We were discussing like how everybody wanted The Expanse to continue. it's, you know, it's one of those shows that ended definitely on a high note, you know, but like we were talking about, it is something you can conceive of being a real progression of society and what would be like a couple hundred years or however far in the future it is. But just generally, what was your favorite aspect of playing that character, Avicerala? What was it that you really, if you look back and go, this is what made it really worthwhile to play her?
What really attracted me to her was the fact that she was this powerful, strong, highly educated politician who also had a soft spot for humanity. The mixture of them both made me, because although Margaret Thatcher is one of my favorite politicians of all times, but still, I wish that she had that soft spot when the right time comes to use it. But she didn't. She didn't have that soft spot. Avicerala did.
And that's something that really was interesting, the empathy that mm-hmm. kind of grew over time and the relationships and the, even the, I mean, there was a point in time, there was a lot of physicality.
Oh my God, yes.
You know, you're no longer in these beautiful gowns and all this. I think one episode you're in the spacesuit.
My God. All the crew loved me in the spacesuit. As soon as I walked onto the set, everybody is saying that, wow, wear a spacesuit from now on. This suits you so well. And I loved it because I was a bit uncomfortable leaving, traditional Indian dresses that nearly covers all your body and changing into a spacesuit that shows every fine line in your body. But yeah. But when they said, when they cheered and they said, it suits you, my problem was solved.
You're looking at that, and I think you were, at that last time I was trying to speak with you, I think you were filming Renfield, I think.
Renfield.
Where did y'all shoot that?
New Orleans. It's the best place that this movie could have been made at. My first day off, I went out to buy some souvenirs for my daughter and, you know, friends. And guess what? I found a beautiful box with a rosary in it, small Bible, and a small bottle of water, perhaps it was, to shoo away the devil. And I thought, do people still believe in this? And the shopkeeper said, yes, in New Orleans we do. And I said, bravo, we had to make this film here because people do believe in it.
Where were you staying in, when you were there? Because that's where most of the acting I did. Actually, I was out of New Orleans. I'm from Dallas originally, but I've lived there for like on and off for about 25 years. And then my youngest daughter graduated high school. Now we're in South Padre Island, Texas. I needed to get the beach life going on. But New Orleans it's so funny because I lived in the suburbs. But, you know, people don't know there's really, it's got a bunch of little areas, little micro
pockets. Yeah, exactly.
Where were you staying when you were down there?
Four Seasons Hotel. But the problem was that it's one of the best. Four Seasons is obviously hotels are the best. First night I go to sleep because the call is at 6 a.m. and I go to bed at 10 p.m. and I do ceremonial stuff that I need to do before going to sleep. And I try to sleep, and all of a sudden I hear, you know, the roll drums, and then the songs. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? I call the concierge, and they said, oh, it's Mardi Gras. We're having a festival. And I'm like, three nights of that. And then one night was calm, and then the night after, again, drum rolls and stuff. They're singing, and what's going on? It's March Madness. Oh my God, they're so close. Every single night. And every day I went out, people, thousands of them, crowded streets, bustling, you know, and people are having fun. They're drinking on the face of the streets. They're smoking and going up and down, having fun. And I'm thinking, do these people work at all? Because they party at night. They go, what do they do? What do they do? But I loved it. I loved it.
One of the greatest places in the world to go for a long weekend, but living there, it's a whole different story. It will say love, hate. We'll put it like that. But the food is good. Can't complain about the food at all. But you did, didn't you, during COVID, you did a food web series, a cooking show of some sort, correct?
Yes. I was working still during the COVID. We did season 6 during the COVID. I remember every single morning we had to go for a poke. And then I thought, I told a friend of mine, I said, if they had told us that one day, you need to do this before you go to work. Somebody has to put something in up your nose. I would have said no, thank you. I'm not going to do this.
Yeah, I can't tell you the amount of interviews I've done when at least a couple of times somebody said, "Oh, hang on, I got to go to my door." Somebody showed up to their front door in LA to give them their COVID test for the day. It was so funny because that was like a regular feature on my show that I had to edit out. You know, your cooking thing you did on the web. Now, is that mostly what kind of food were you cooking?
Persian. It wasn't. I only did 3 because I didn't have time as much. I only did 3. All Persian food, and mostly rice based, because Americans have recently discovered rice and they're loving it. They start loving it. I remember 30 years ago, every time I put rice on my table for my American friends, they weren't very happy about it. They liked, they were more happy with chickens and, you know, kebabs and stuff. But now it's the rice that finishes first. So yeah, it was mostly rice-based.
Well, that actually brings me to something I like to ask. I call it my 7 questions, which is just a little extra fun I like to have. And I got to know, the first question I always like to ask my guest, because I'm a food nerd, I love food, love cooking, is what is your favorite comfort food? What is for you that thing that's just, if you have an amazing day, you want it. If you've had a bad day, it makes you feel better. What is that food?
Pasta. Any kind of pasta, yeah.
I'd say that's a pretty high batting average. Most people like a pasta of some sort. I do have to ask, though, as far as Persian food, what is kind of the, like an iconic, if you were to go and have Persian food, you got to have, like, if you say Greek food, souvlaki or pasticcio or whatever, but if I said Persian food, what is something that's on the Mount Rushmore of Persian food, you've got to try it?
Something that my friends, my American friends love, British and American, gourmet sabzi. Gourmet is gourmet. Sabzi is vegetable. Gourmet sabzi means a celebration of all kind of vegetables, many kind of vegetables. Gourmet sabzi. This is, I mean, Westerners love it. They love it. Where do you live? Maybe I can cook it for you. Where are you? Where do you live?
That's so sweet. I'm actually on South Padre Island, Texas, right at the very tip. Just a matter of a few miles from Mexico, actually. So, no, I've been looking for my Jimmy Buffett lifestyle.
God bless you.
But that's so sweet. You know, maybe I could get a recipe from you. I love the challenge of new recipes, and then I always do them by the book at first, but I always play with it after that. I always kind of like put my own little spin on it. You know.
Of course, no matter what. Of course, it's. Really interesting. I was, I keep learning myself. The other day, I was trying to make a dessert, which very, very much like Persian dessert. And the instructions said that I had to put 1.5 glass of sugar in it, which I did. At the beginning, when I try to copy them, I go exactly, you know, what they tell me to do, I do that. But then I noticed it was too sweet. Next time I make it, I would use only 1 cup of sugar, not 1.5 cups. You're right. We need to have our own modifications, I mean, no matter what.
It's improvisation in my the way I look at it. You know, when you're cooking, that's the reason why I'm not a baker. I can't do the baking thing because it's too rigid. But I like the free form of just a little this, little that. You know, one of the questions I had, the second question of my seven, is if you could sit down with three people and talk story over coffee, living or not, who would those three people be that you would love to sit down and have conversation and coffee for hours?
Chekhov, Anton Chekhov. This man had so much to tell. And I love the way he looks at life. His stories are so human.
Well, it all kind of started with him, kind of, you know, Chekhov kind of started the whole Stanislavski, even Meisner, and
Yeah, indeed. And what I love about him is that in his stories, everybody is innocent, but yet at the same time, everybody could be blamed for their wrongdoings, just in real life. Definitely Anton Chekhov, and who else? Sadhguru. Sadhguru is an Indian philosopher. I keep watching his clips, listening to his podcasts. And I learn a lot from him.
Oh, okay. I think I might know who that is, actually.
Tell you who else. Here in Hollywood, he has a lot of fans. But the one who is very, very much all the time with him or tries to be with him is Will Smith.
Oh, okay.
Because of Will, he even came to Los Angeles to visit him. He rides a motorbike. He travels with a motorbike around the world. He's an amazing, amazing person, a philosopher, philosophy of life. If you want to hear real stuff, it's either him or Rajneesh, those two. But Guru, Sadhguru, is more relative.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, he's I want to say a young guy, but he's probably in his 60s, maybe, so, you know, roughly.
He is, yes. 65, 66, yeah, he is.
Okay.
And the third person would definitely be Tarkovsky. I never got to talk to him. I went to his, he had a, what was it? It was when I was studying back in London. I don't remember the college that he was giving a speech at, but I went to see him, and everybody got to ask their questions. But as soon as I started asking questions, time was up. So I need to see him again and talk to him and ask him a couple of great questions that I have. So what about you? I'm dying to see the three people that you would.
Oh, you know, it's you're the first person I ever asked. Excuse me, as I'm taking my cup of coffee. Now, I would love to talk to Shohreh Aghdashloo. Oh, I'm doing that. I've always been a fan. When I worked on the radio in LA, I lived in Encinitas, the North County of San Diego. And I would always do the same thing. I'd always go through In-N-Out Burger, get a chocolate shake, and just head south. And I'd always listen to Alan Watts. Radio Pacifica, you know, the philosopher Alan Watts. I think he died like roughly 1973 or so. He was kind of a pop culture philosopher, for lack of a better way of putting it. I would love to sit down with my grandfather who passed back about almost exactly 20 years ago. I'm just realizing that, and just kind of catch up, bring him up to speed. Because it's always when people. You know, it's one of those things about growing up. You don't realize the questions you should ask until they're gone. Sometimes, you know, those questions, those poor family questions.
Yes, yes, yes. Not just questions. Take pictures of them. I every time I think about, you know, the good moments that I had with them, and I did not preserve it by either taking a picture or taking a note or something. Yeah. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Okay, second one.
There's following Nolan Ryan, who is the pitcher for the Texas Rangers. He's asking somebody, you know, someone who has performed at the highest level you can reach, and those people that make it somehow seem effortless. Those are the interesting ones to speak with, because you know they're still putting in work. They just make it look effortless.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
the thinkers, you know, it's so funny. I was thinking about this the other day, and now I can't think of the of who it was I was thinking of as I was putting this together. And I always ask this question. It's the philosophers, the people who maybe give you, have you think a different way than you have before, that kind of help you grow and remind you, no matter your age, you can still grow. You know, and those kind of people are always fascinating. I gotta think about that, because I always ask this question. I know my grandfather's always on there, Alan Watts, and of course the sports thing. I'm gonna have to think about that for a moment. I should be able to answer my own questions better. but
the bet you did a great job.
oh, thank you. The next question, and the when you were young, who was your very first celebrity crush? You know, someone you saw is like, oh, you know, they stole your heart. They captivated you. They had you intrigued. You know, who would that be?
I would say Richard Burton.
Richard Burton. Oh, okay.
Of course.
Well, that begs the question. Was there anybody that you ever in Iran or you came over here that you would like, you just admired them and you just, you just adored them and you had the opportunity to work with them? Besides Sir Ben Kingsley, of course. But was there anybody else you got a chance to work with and you were like, you had been admiring them from afar for a long time?
Of course. First and foremost is Sandra Bullock. Loved working with her. When I came here, they kept referring to her as the girl next door. And I was wondering, what does it mean? She is the girl next door. Soon as I started working with her, we were all the time together, because she believes in interacting as well, because real actors do not believe in acting only. It's about, although we call it acting, but it's about interacting. It takes two to tango. We are having a conversation here. I am not on my own. Therefore, you need to work with me. You need to give me something so I can give you something back.
But they say acting is reacting. Yeah.
Acting is reacting. And she's the one, I mean, it's in her DNA. And also Keanu Reeves. Loved working with that gentleman.
Oh, yeah.
Loved working with him. It's unbelievable. Incredible. Working with him. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's actually to answer, he is on the short list. The three people to sit down with, you look at the arc of his career, but also the way he's chosen to live his life. And he does have kind of an interesting way of living by example and kind of his, you know, I never had a chance to work with or meet him, but he seems like he'd be a wonderful person to sit down with and just kind of pick his brain.
Incredible. Incredible, no matter what, inside out. What I loved about him, obviously he's a star, but he doesn't consider himself as a star. He considers himself as a humble actor. I could say that from the way he behaves. He never dashed in with his entourage, never was late, always on time, if not early, never dashed out with his entourage, even during the change of lights. He would just grab a chair, take it to a corner, sit there, wait for the lights to change. He wouldn't just make a huge exit. And he was just incredible to work with.
You know, you've had the opportunity to see some things, you know, you said the huge exit. I've only been on a handful of sets, but I've never seen the big exit before. I kind of want to be on a movie set now and see this big exit. I'm sure you've seen people who will remain nameless, but that I didn't realize that was a thing to create a spectacle on your way out.
I've seen a couple of those. And now I am leaving.
With a flourish, yes. Now, the next question I've got for you is, if you're going to be on an exotic island, somewhere that you actually want to be, you're not a castaway, but there's no internet, you can bring a CD of an album, a DVD of a movie. So an album and a movie, something you could watch for a full year. You know, you're going to be on an island for a year. What would that be? Something you could watch and listen to over and over again.
Frank Sinatra, I Did It My Way. I can listen to that song for hours because I can relate to it really well. I did it my way.
Indeed you did, yes.
Yes, and for a movie that I can watch, not year round, but every couple of times a week, My Beautiful Life.
No, real quick, I didn't ask you about your daughter. Is she, little side note, is she in acting as well, or is she in the industry, or she went a different direction?
She's in the industry. She studied directing at Chapman University. And now she's doing minimal jobs, of course. You know how long it takes for female to become directors in Hollywood. So she's taking her sweet time. She's making short films, inexpensive short films, music videos, whatever she can do to get there.
It's got to be nice, though, you know, where you can compare notes. And she, I don't think any of my kids are going to choose what I do, you know, anything remotely like that. But it's got to be kind of nice to be able to have, I'm assuming she lives in L.A. as well?
She does, yes. Not with me, but yeah, she's in L.A., yes. To be honest with you, I didn't want my daughter, I didn't want to force her to follow up my life or do similar stuff that I did in life. But obviously, daughters go after their mothers, no matter what. So she was 16 when she said that she wanted to study directing. And I told her my reasons. I said, you won't have a life, you know that. You know how many times I missed your birthdays. You know how many times I missed going to the reunions with my parents. There's a lot that you have to sacrifice for.
Plus, being a director, you're married to something for a full year at least, whereas actors, you know, got it easy. You show up for your thing and you're
yes.
done. Or directors, yes. that's a marriage almost for a year, at least a year.
It is, no matter what.
Now, the next question I got for you, if you were to define from the time you get up until the time you put your head on the pillow at night, if you were to define a perfect day, you know, the component parts, the things that make up a perfect day for you, what would those things be?
A perfect day. If I'm not working, I'm at home. Perfect day for me is when nobody needs me. I'm not needed. I'm not supposed to be anywhere at a certain time.
Oh, I'm you know what? You're the first person to ever say that, but I feel that so much. Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to remember. Yeah, that idea where you are not obligated to anything and you can just, yes, I appreciate that.
Exactly. I can live my life. Have you ever noticed that while walking on a street, you see people who are walking towards a certain direction and then all of a sudden they stop, they turn around and stop walking back, you know, backward, going back to where they were before. And you wonder, my God, you are so lucky. You don't have to do anything. You're just wandering around, exploring ideas, going up the street, now down the street, scrolling down. You have the luxury to do that. But I don't have the luxury. I have to be somewhere at 11:30 a.m. no matter what, and I don't want to be
but
late.
Isn't that the most creative that you can be? I know I had a golden retriever who actually passed about a year ago, and we would go for walks, and some of my best thinking ideas I'd come up with and just go for meandering, you know, no real plan.
Yes.
And that's kind of an analogy for kind of like, I find I'm the most creative when I'm not on the clock, when I don't have a regiment. I can kind of daydream, if you will.
Of course, because you allow yourself to sit down and pay attention to your thoughts, inner thoughts, what is going on. But when you're working, your attention is scattered. You're not able to do that. Obviously, we're far more creative when we are on our own and we're not in a hurry. We're not under pressure or stress. And we can freely explore ideas, yeah.
So the day starts for you with no real obligations. What are you liking to fill your day with? Not fill your day, but what are those component things that are making it a great day for you? Besides not, you know, you can actually turn your phone off if you want.
And that I'm afraid I cannot do. None of us can do that. But an ideal day would be for me to walk. I walk a lot here around our house. It's beautiful. It has really nice steps, you know, up and down, up and down. It helps a lot, you know, when I start walking. And if the weather allows, I would love to swim. I'm a swimmer, really, like an hour a day, 45 minutes a day. And I think that's the best thing that one can do for themselves, because when you swim from head to toe, you just try to, you know, move your body in every which way. And I could read a couple of pages of my favorite book that is next to my bed, or play solitaire, which I love. And that's my guilty pleasure.
I'm getting a feeling you really appreciate your alone time. You appreciate being in your own bubble when you can be. Yeah. I gather you appreciate that a lot because you are working so much that you do savor those moments.
Maybe that's why. Maybe that's why, because I work a lot when I'm alone, when I'm home, when I'm not doing anything. I try to save as much as I can, and I usually do. And I have a feeling that while you have a zest for life, I have a zest for life no matter what, whether I'm on the stage set or at home, you want to be kind of alert, pay attention to everything that is going on in your own small world. And to be able to just sit down and discover and talk, you know, explore ideas. It's a lot easier to do that rather than when you're working.
Well, we're talking about those people that I would love to sit down with. And I mentioned Alan Watts, and I remember one of the things he talked about. He says, if we're talking about living in the moment and how we don't do that. We're always planning for the next thing. He said, if you're always planning, you are never in this moment. And so that's one of those things I tried to, for myself, do, is just kind of stop. Even the decision of living, you know, just taking a walk on the beach. It's like you push everything else to the side and you're just there. And you mentioned taking a walk, and that's still one of my favorite things to do. Which means I have to get another puppy or another dog, because without a dog, I don't walk nearly as much.
You have to.
The next question I got is, if you weren't doing this, if this was not your career vocation, what else could you see yourself doing?
Teacher. From day one, I wanted to be a teacher. Yeah. Because
anything in particular that you would like to teach or discuss? Or
not necessarily. Depends on where I am, what I'm doing, what's necessary to teach. Because I have this urge in me that whatever I have learned, I need to pass it on. I gave my first Farsi speaking masterclass in Toronto last week. And I always do it for free, because I learned acting for free. And that's why I think it depends on who you are, where you are, and, you know, kind of how you would like to be in life. Yeah,
I think that probably evolves over time based on what you've learned and what you know you can share and who you meet and who you think you can benefit from.
Exactly.
Because what they say about acting, it's like everybody, they say steals. You don't really steal, but it's all kind of a constant evolution. You know, you're learning from others who learned from people before them.
Oh my God. When we get to that, we really have to mention that most of the Western literature is based on Bible. It's been inspired by Bible. Look at Ingmar Bergman's works. They're all, each and every one of them is inspired by the Bible. So that is totally understandable. It doesn't matter. We learn from one another. We're not copying one another. We just learn from one another.
Yeah, and Sherry, and I think that helps you, the you know, to be a more empathetic person and, you know, appreciate the people around you.
But it's just, you know, small stuff that they don't teach you at universities, at colleges. Like, for example, in this masterclass, what I said to my pupils were the fact that acting, creating, all of, you know, at the time of creation, all you need to do is to be honest with yourself, is to think thoroughly, is to go in and bring it from within. You cannot just pretend that you know the answer to the question you're asking yourself. Give yourself some time and then come up then you can come up with something tangible, something that you can pass on. Like, for example, I told them that staying in the moment all depends on listening and watching. We say, I watched a movie. And we say, I saw a movie. When we say, I saw, meaning that I didn't watch it. For example, I tell you, oh, do you remember the scene where he slaps his wife? And you said, nah, is there such a scene? I don't remember, because you weren't paying attention entirely to this.
I think that's why a lot of people do say that going to the theater, you really want to watch something because you're not at home distracted as much. So yes, there's a zen to going to the theater as opposed to being at home, and you're less distracted from other stuff and you're really watching it. Yeah.
But again, if you're disciplined and if you have a lot of imagination at your disposal, as actors have, no matter what, you just sit down, watch television, and you think that you are in a cinema watching this, and everywhere is dark. That's the power of imagination that we have at our disposal.
It's funny, whenever we watch a movie, my son, he's the one that's like, can we turn the lights off? You know, he's like, that does create a focus, you know?
Yes.
Now, the last question I've got for you is, if you were to jump into the, you know, Back to the Future, the DeLorean, you know, and you go back in time to 16-year-old you, you've got a few minutes with you. What's a piece of advice that you would offer yourself to either put you on a better path or maybe make the moment you're in better in some way? But what would be that piece of advice that you'd like to offer yourself, 16-year-old you?
Be brave, but be careful. Be a strong, but don't be a stupid. Be understanding, but don't get yourself involved with people's stories. Try to understand them. Try not to get involved. Do not.
I think
stop.
That's what your 20s is for. Your 20s is a lesson to those things you just mentioned, to really try and master that. You know, it's
yeah. Which I did with myself. Yeah.
Well, I think that's part of growing. You know, it was somebody told, I saw something the other day that for a guy, if you don't look back on yourself in your early 20s and think, what an idiot, you haven't grown at all. I don't know how true that is. I have those intermittent cringe moments. I'm like, did I do that? Did I say that? God, yeah. I was a knucklehead.
Mark, I saw a clip last night. It's a picture of a young man with his shirt open, too much open, with hair and stuff, and a medallion right here with a lot of hair. And the guy, who is now in his 60s, says, Antonio, the caption said, I wish this guy was still alive. I wish I could visit myself back then and give him a good slap for this style of.
It's also the times you lived in, you know, like I know that, but it's so funny. My grandmother, rest her soul, always said that she held on all of her fashion. She was my grandfather, you know, women's fashions as well. You know, he worked in that industry. And she said, if you hold on to it long enough, the style comes back around.
She's right. She's right. She's right.
I so adore you, and I appreciate you taking time out to just spend some time with me today. That means so much to me. I know you're so busy. I wanted to connect with you the last year and a half, I think, since I started the show. But I know you're fortunate in being so busy with fun work. So I'm very just elated for you. It's so ironic that we spoke. Majority of my day spent doing voiceover, and I know you do wonderful voiceover and characters and stuff. We didn't have, maybe for another day, we'll have a chance to discuss that.
By all means.
But now, you know, I have a mission. I'm going to go try to find a good recipe for gourmet sabzi. Is that how you say
it? Yes. Gourmet sabzi. If you need anything, you have my email. Drop me an email, please. And I send you the, ingredients. I mean, I send you the recipe. There may not be certain kind of ingredients there. I can always post it for you. But first, let me send it to you.
Sheree, I appreciate your time. I know you're very busy, and I'm glad we finally had a chance to connect. But have a wonderful day. Enjoy a nice swim, a cup of coffee or tea, and I look forward to catching up with you down the line.
Me too, Mark. You take care of yourself. My love and regards to the family.
All right, there you go. The lovely, the talented Sheree Agadashloo. I really enjoyed chatting with her. I've wanted to have Sheree on for some time, and finally got a chance to sit down and chat with her. And it got a great recipe out of the deal. I mean, how can you go wrong? You know me, love doing some cooking. Hey, by the way, again, if you would, cruise right on over to whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you subscribe to the show. That way you get notified every single time we have a new episode pop up. Also, leave a review, throw some stars at me, whatever you want to do, depending on your platform you use to listen to the show. Don't forget, storyandcraftpod.com. storyandcraftpod.com. Once again, storyandcraftpod.com. It's how you find out everything you could possibly want to know about the show. So pop on over there and just check it out. All right, so I'm going to get on out of here. Going to go hit the beach, do a little walk, and I want you to have yourself a rock star rest of your day, rest of your week, weekend, whatever you're doing. Thank you for sharing some time with me right here. Going to be back. Another cool episode is coming right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story. Come on.